Today is Monday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protesters in Myanmar continue their opposition to military rule despite rising death tolls.
With the latest killing, the death toll since the coup rose to at least 248.
Plus, rallies in the United States call for an end to violence against Asians.
It breaks your heart to know when Asian Americans walk down the street that they're worried that they might be confronted with someone who's violent.
And spring is finally here in North America. We'll have these stories and more next. Demonstrators in Myanmar maintained their unflinching opposition to military rule Sunday despite a rising death toll at the hands of security forces. This as the junta appears equally determined to resist growing outside pressure to compromise. Reuters' Edward Barayan is up first.
A convoy of hundreds of protesters on motorbikes drove through the southern city of Dawei on Sunday, joining demonstrators around the country. While the junta appeared equally determined to resist growing outside pressure to compromise, at least one person was killed and several wounded when police opened fire on a group setting up a barricade in the central town of Moniwa. After a decade of tentative steps towards democracy, the violence has forced people determined to resist a return to military rule to think up new ways to take a stand. Hundreds of people in the second city of Mandalay, including many medical staff in white coats, marched before sunrise. With the latest killing, the death toll since the coup rose to at least 248, based on a tally by the Assistance Association of Political Prisoners activist group. The junta says a November 8 election, won by Nobel Peace laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's party, was fraudulent, an accusation rejected by the Electoral Commission. Military leaders have promised a new election, but have not set a date.
Edward Barayan from Reuters News. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the Georgia state capitol in Atlanta on Saturday in support of the Asian American community after a shooting at three local day spas last week left eight people dead, six of whom were Asian women. The killings followed a year of mounting anti-Asian violence in the United States, which community leaders say is due to Asian Americans being blamed for the coronavirus, which was first identified in Wuhan, China, in late 2019. Georgia State Representative B. Nguyen.
We have lived in the shadows, invisible, overlooked, stereotyped, and relegated as second-class citizens. And now, in the wake of a violent and brutal shooting, white America is still trying to deny our humanity and existence. A 21-year-old white man targeted three Asian businesses, driving 40 minutes from one spa to another, passing other adult entertainment businesses. But he shot and killed eight people, six of them being Asian women, at close range, in the head. No matter how you want to spin it, the facts remain the same. This was an attack on the Asian community.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says anti-Asian hate and attacks must end.
It breaks your heart to know when Asian Americans walk down the street that they're worried that they might be confronted with someone who's violent. This has to stop.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris denounced attacks on Asian Americans after meeting with community leaders in Atlanta, Georgia, Friday. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara has that part of the story.
They've been attacked, blamed, scapegoated, and harassed. They've been verbally assaulted, physically assaulted, killed. Documented incidents of hate against Asian Americans have seen a skyrocketing spike.
Proving that an attack is motivated by traits like race, religion, and sexual orientation is often challenging, but it's important to charge it as a hate crime when it meets the legal standard, experts say. Byung-jae Park is a former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia.
Having a statute on books like that gives a level of comfort to communities of color, people who are in protected classes. And so it's very important that the statute actually is used when appropriate and not just be a figurehead on the statute books.
Atlanta authorities have not ruled out charging the suspect, Robert Aaron Long, with hate crimes on top of 8 counts of murder. Meanwhile, Biden is urging Congress to pass the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act, saying it would expedite federal response to the rise of hate crimes exacerbated during the pandemic and support state and local governments to improve hate crimes reporting and deterrence. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Sunday criticized Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's surprise withdrawal from a European treaty aimed at protecting women against violence. In 2011, Turkey was the first European country to adopt the pact known as the Istanbul Convention, but Erdogan withdrew from it early Saturday. In recent years, Erdogan and other members of his ruling party claimed the agreement undermined the country's conservative policies. The accord was aimed at eliminating domestic violence and promoting equality, but femicide has nonetheless surged in Turkey in recent years. Russian jets hit rebel training camps Sunday in northwestern Syria near the Turkish border. In addition, witnesses and rebel sources told Reuters News that Syrian artillery killed 7 civilians and injured 14 medics in an attack on a hospital in the area. Fighting between Syrian army forces and rebels has subsided since a deal a year ago ended a Russian-led bombing campaign that had displaced more than 1 million people in the region that borders Turkey. Before that, months of fighting had killed several thousand civilians. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin Sunday made his first visit to Afghanistan since taking up his post as Washington considers whether to comply with a May 1st deadline for pulling out all troops from the country under a year-old deal it signed with the Taliban. Austin held a meeting with President Ashraf Ghani after arriving in Kabul. A Pentagon report quoted Austin as saying that he visited Afghanistan to listen and learn and that he wanted to understand what Ghani's concerns were. An Afghan presidential statement said Ghani and Austin expressed concern over the high level of violence and stressed the need to find a just and lasting peace in Afghanistan. Austin also met with American and coalition leaders in Kabul to better understand the situation and see the way forward to a just peace in the long troubled South Asian nation. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says civilians who have fled violence in Mozambique's war-torn Cabo Delgado region are living in appalling conditions. The group says survivors of the fighting are also suffering from mental trauma. And to learn more, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Jonathan Whittle, the head of MSF's analysis department, who just returned from the region.
What I saw, Jason, was a situation of extremely high humanitarian needs. We are seeing a huge amount of displacement, people living in appalling conditions. The level of needs are growing. This is not something that is improving. So we're really seeing a deterioration of the situation. I saw families that have been separated, living in horrific conditions in a way that is really conducive to the outbreak of diseases such as cholera. And I also saw a generally lacking humanitarian response. The needs that are existing on the ground are not being adequately addressed. And this is something that is very concerning for us when we see the conditions that people are living in particular.
And what are some of the health needs that you're seeing?
For example, we are working in camps where people have settled around the capital city of Pemba. We are finding a situation where people that have been displaced have been walking for days in some cases to find safety. They've walked long distances. They arrive dehydrated, hungry, into conditions that are very difficult in the camps. Many of them have walked past the bodies of fellow village members while they've been fleeing their villages. So they arrive into these areas to find safety. But what they find is extremely difficult living conditions, overcrowding, poor shelter, lack of access to clean water, no health care. Malaria is a problem.
You mentioned people passing bodies of villagers. This is a conflict situation. So what about the mental health aspect in terms of the trauma that these people have experienced? Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Mental health is a big part of our response as well. So the healthcare that we provide as Doctors Without Borders includes a strong focus on mental health. And it's not only helping people to deal with the trauma that they've experienced in leaving behind their village, often in a situation of extreme violence, but also leaving behind their livelihoods, their lives, and finding shelter in a place that poses significant challenges to their ongoing survival and lives. And this requires a huge amount of support. It requires particular attention for children. The number of children that have been displaced is extremely high. So in the camps, you have sometimes almost up to 50% of the camp population, the displaced population, are children. And they require particular attention to process and to be able to deal with the mental health impacts of this conflict.
You also mentioned that the situation is deteriorating. So what can be done to address the root causes here so that people don't have to flee from their homes and don't have to live in these conditions?
What we see as Doctors Without Borders is the consequence of a failure to address these root causes. And as a medical organization, it's difficult for us to find the solutions to these problems. But what I can say is that it's a matter of extreme urgency to address the root causes. I think what else that we would like to see is that we're not so alone in responding to the failure to address those root causes. I think the humanitarian needs that people are experiencing as a result of this conflict, the emergency that the province is in, requires a humanitarian mobilization greater than the one that we see today on the ground.
That was Doctors Without Borders Head of Analysis Department Jonathan Whittle in Johannesburg, South Africa, speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
An astronomer in Hawaii spotted an odd object passing through the solar system in October 2017. It was named Oumuamua, which is Hawaiian for scout or messenger. Other scientists found evidence that it came from another planetary system, making it the first interstellar object to be found in our solar system. Since its discovery, astronomers have argued back and forth whether it was a comet or an asteroid. Others, including a respected theoretical physicist, speculated that Oumuamua could be an alien-devised probe or artifact. Scientists say the object had features that defied classification. Now, scientists at the Arizona State University have determined that the object is likely a piece of a Pluto-like planet from another solar system and is shaped like a pancake instead of a cigar as first thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Reuters reporter Jason Albino has this update on two Canadians held in China facing criminal charges in what is seen as part of a wider spat between Ottawa and Beijing.
A Chinese court held its first trial of a Canadian citizen charged with espionage on Friday, but it was the timing that raised a few eyebrows. The trial of businessman Michael Spavor was held in Dandong, across the border from North Korea, where he regularly went for work. Spavor was one of what the Canadian press has called the two Michaels. Both are Canadians arrested by Beijing more than 2 years ago. That happened not long after police in Vancouver detained Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Chinese telecoms giant Huawei, on a U.S. warrant. Beijing has denied that the arrests of the two Canadians were in retaliation. Canadian officials said they were denied access to Friday's trial on national security grounds. Jim Nickel, the deputy head of the Canadian embassy in Beijing, expressed his disappointment.
There is an obligation on the Chinese authorities' part to admit consular officials to attend hearings of our citizens. So we are disappointed in the lack of access and the lack of transparency.
Hours after the trial ended, Beijing said it would set a later date for a verdict. China has a conviction rate of over 99%. Meng Wanzhou remains on house arrest in Vancouver as she fights extradition to the United States. While Beijing has denied a link, Spavor's trial coincides with the first ever talks between Beijing and Washington since President Joe Biden took office. A former Canadian ambassador said Beijing has its eye on Meng's release. Some observers have said convictions of both men could facilitate a diplomatic agreement in which the pair are released and sent back to Canada. The other arrested Canadian, former diplomat Michael Kovrig, is set to appear in court on Monday.
Reuters' Jason Albano. Testing is underway for modified versions of COVID-19 vaccines that aim to deal with coronavirus variants. Experts say current vaccines still seem to work against the variants and prevent the most severe forms of the disease, though the evidence is limited. To learn more, I spoke with VOA science reporter Steve Barragona.
The good news is, for the most part, they all work pretty well. It does vary somewhat by vaccine and by variant. So I guess the good news first, there's this variant that first arose in the UK, known colloquially as B117. And the vaccines seem to work pretty well against that one. And we actually have some real world data on that. We've got several vaccines that are rolling out that are in use in the UK, and they seem to be working quite well against that that particular strain. And you know, a lot of what we've known so far about these vaccines has been from clinical trials, which is very very carefully controlled environment. So it's really good to see that when you actually do this in the real world, they still work. So that's been great. So the kind of less good news is coming out of South Africa, where there's a variant there called B1351 that it's able to kind of get around the vaccines to a certain extent. Now, the good news is all the vaccines that have been tested in South Africa still seem to prevent serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And that's super important. I mean, that's why COVID is such a problem, right? It's because it kills people. And if we have vaccines that keep people from dying, keep them out of the hospital, that's fantastic. Now, we do know that with like the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, for example, they did a clinical trial in South Africa, and the vaccine was less effective at preventing kind of any sort of disease, mild, moderate, severe disease, is about 57%, which is not great. In the U.S., for example, it was like 72%. So, you know, this variant is obviously able to get around the vaccines to a certain extent. Again, in the Johnson & Johnson trial, nobody died. Nobody went to the hospital. So that's really good news. The kind of most concerning aspect is with the AstraZeneca vaccine. Still some things we don't know about found that it didn't work very well against the virus. Now, that was only looking at mild to moderate cases of COVID-19. They were not able to study. They didn't have enough people in the study to get any sense of how well it works against severe disease. And, you know, the experts say it's probably still going to protect you from severe disease and death. And that, again, is the point of these vaccines.
And we should note that the European Medicines Agency, or the EMA, which is the drug regulator in Europe, said on Thursday that AstraZeneca is safe and effective in protecting people from the disease, and its benefits outweigh possible risk. And this is according to its internal study that it conducted in wake of these concerns about the efficacy of AstraZeneca and the possible link between that vaccine and blood clots.
So it's you know, a mixed picture, but for the most part, most folks are saying, look, whatever vaccine you're offered, you should take it because it's probably going to help you a heck of a lot more than not getting vaccinated.
Now, what about moving forward? Because there has been some discussions about whether or not, you know, taking a COVID-19 vaccine may become an annual event, just like the flu vaccine is. Perhaps there is a need for a so-called booster shot. You know, once you get a vaccine, you need to have a second one because of the variants. What are, you know, the professionals saying?
I mean, I think the big picture right now is we don't know. It may very well be. That's basically all they can say at this point is it's probably a good idea to start looking at these things, whether we need to change the vaccine itself or give an additional dose, now is probably the time to start looking at how well these things might work. But we can't say for sure, because mostly because these vaccines do seem to be working okay. And if they work, then there's not really a need to change anything. But just in case, all of the manufacturers are working on some kind of modification. So, like, for example, Moderna has, they've actually just redesigned the vaccine, basically, which is really easy for these kinds of vaccines. These are vaccines that are made with genetic instructions rather than, you know, the old kind of vaccines where, like, they would give you either a dead version of the, if it's, you know, you're talking about a virus vaccine, they'd give you a dead version of the virus or a piece of the virus or something. These vaccines are totally different. They instead give your body instructions for how to make a piece of the virus, and your body makes it by itself, and that's what triggers the immune response.
VOA science reporter Steve Barragona. Though Washington is the seat of U.S. political power, its residents have no voting rights in Congress, nor rights of full home rule because of its unique status as a federal capital. But advocates for making Washington, D.C. a state say they see more potential than ever. VOA's Carol Gunsberg has that story.
When rioters attacked the U.S. Capitol in a failed attempt to stop Congress from certifying the presidential election of Joe Biden, Washington's Mayor Muriel Bowser lacked the authority to call in the National Guard to help police. The episode has given new momentum to the District of Columbia's long-running effort to become a state.
I'm upset that 706,000 residents of the District of Columbia did not have a single vote in that Congress yesterday, despite the fact that our people were putting their lives on the line to protect our democracy.
The district lacks local autonomy. Its budget and local laws, unlike those of states, are subject to approval by Congress. Its residents pay federal taxes, but cannot send someone to Congress to cast votes on their behalf. Eleanor Holmes Norton has championed statehood for three decades as the district's non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives.
The United States is the only country that denies the residents of its capital city the same rights that everybody else has.
Norton introduced legislation, passed by the House last year, that would shrink the federal district to 2 square miles, including the Capitol, White House, and other major government buildings and monuments. The district's remaining 66 square miles would become the new state. The legislation was reintroduced in January with even more backers.
What is important is that we have the support of the new president of the United States, Joe Biden, as well as the support of the leaders of the Senate and of the House. That's a trifecta that's hard to beat.
But Republicans in Congress oppose statehood. Because the district's voters overwhelmingly support Democrats, that would mean two more Democrats in a Senate that is now evenly divided between the two major parties. Republican Congressman Dusty Johnson says Washingtonians do deserve representation, just not in a separate new state. His proposed legislation would make most of the district part of the neighboring state of Maryland without adding seats in the House or Senate.
And if what D.C. residents really want is suffrage, if what they want is a voice in the United States Senate, my plan gives them that. I would say in the last 200 years, every single state that has been made a state has had either 6 million residents or has been 10,000 square miles. Washington, D.C. fails both of those tests.
But joining another state is just not acceptable to Washington pharmacist Oye Owowola.
We don't want to be residents of Maryland. We want to be D.C. residents. We also want to have our own voice. We want to be the 51st state, not to be absorbed in another one.
D.C. voters elected Owowola last fall as a backup delegate in the House of Representatives. He was born in the U.S. to parents from Nigeria, where residents of the federal capital region do have legislative representatives with voting rights. Attorney Paul Strauss is one of the district's two elected shadow senators, again, without voting rights. His goal is
to educate both Americans and the world about the importance of D.C. statehood and making sure that the United States lives up to the ideals that it preaches around the world.
A House panel will consider Norton's bill this month. While it may pass in the democratically controlled House, it is unlikely to pass in the Senate, where Democrats have only a slim margin of control. Carol Gunsberg, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, this past weekend saw the official start of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, and for millennia, the coming of spring has been an occasion for ritual renewal and celebration. For this report, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to some Americans who are getting into the spirit of spring by using goddess and nature-based imagery culled from the ancient past and in their own backyards.
Birds do it.
The song may be old-fashioned, but the sentiments of love and longing it expresses are up to the minute anywhere in the world where spring is sprung. And according to Anne Hill, co-author of Circle Round, a book about raising children in goddess-centered religions, there is even more to spring than is dreamed of in popular songs.
At spring equinox, the earth is reborn. The snow has melted and the rains have brought mud and slush, but underneath are the green shoots of spring. Symbols of rebirth abound. Eggs, seeds, baby animals decorate store windows and altars.
This sense of renewal lies at the pagan roots of many of the world's religions. For example, the Christian Easter is actually named for Eostar, the ancient Germanic goddess of spring and fertility. Her totem animal was the rabbit. That's where the Easter Bunny comes from. And those eggs he carries were actually a symbol of the circle of life for many pre-Christian goddess religions. Ms. Hill says that for her, discovering the ancient source of Eastern traditions was both revelation and relief.
Having been raised a Christian, Easter was always one of my favorite holidays. You know, you would see flowers everywhere and hunt for the eggs in the grass and the candy. And when I became a pagan and started learning more about goddess tradition, I realized that those weren't exactly Christian symbols originally. So I was very happy to know, to realize that all of the things I loved best about the spring and of Easter were actually symbols of rebirth that I now associate with the spring equinox.
Shoshana Budapest was raised in Hungary, where many of the old peasant traditions are still practiced. She says that nature-based religions rely on observation, not faith. According to her, that can appeal to Americans who mistrust mainstream religions, but who want to feel spiritually in tune.
And I just have to look at my apple tree, and I get this philosophy right away. Apple tree brings fruits. Pick apple tree. Eat apples. Apple tree loses all her leaves. Apple tree looks dead. Apple tree returns with white flowers next spring. So the peasant puts it together. Same with sexuality. Everybody's going into heat, from the squirrels to the kitty cats. I mean, that's what's happening in nature. And then you sit there and you feel it yourself and you start thinking about the girls and boys and you start looking around for a date. And you realize you're part of this force. You are not apart from it at all. You cannot separate yourself from it. And if you do, you get psychotic.
In Earth-centered religions, the dramas in the realm of nature are often mirrored by the activities of gods and goddesses. Starhawk, a second co-author of Circle Round, reads from a story she wrote in which she likens springtime's interplay of Earth and Sun in the physical world to a courtly dance of love in the celestial one.
This is the time of spring's return, the joyful time, the seed time, when life bursts forth from the earth and the chains of winter are broken. The sun stretches out his hand, and the spring maiden returns from the land of the dead, cloaked in the fresh rain, with the sweet scent of desire on her breath. Where they step, the wildflowers appear as they dance. Despair turns to hope, sorrow to joy, want to abundance. May our hearts open with the spring.
Diane Baker, the third co-author of Circle Round, says that children are especially open to lessons that spring has to teach. Whatever your age, she says, the idea is to identify your own growth with the world around you.
I think the spring equinox is a wonderful time to talk about new beginnings, what you want to plant and what you want to grow, and taking some time in the wheel of the year to think about this and share it with your family, ask your children, find out what you can do to help nurture people's dreams.
This is Adam Phillips reporting.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.